because Vitrich's second Panzer Corps, two Panzer divisions, had been pulled out of the Normandy area to get rest and recuperate and get more replacements and so on. And they picked at what they thought was a quiet spot, which it was.
Right.
And they were in there, and in the meantime, they're planning this, Montgomery's plan for this way to break through in the heart of Germany and end the war, hopefully mm-hmm. before the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And the paratroopers paid a terrific price on that because the British 30 Corps couldn't break through down that road.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Germans, you had veteran troops there with heavy stuff, and the British 1st Airborne Division at Arnhem, and they were 6 or 8 miles from their drop where they were supposed to be dropped. And part of them got into Arnhem and they got chopped up and eventually had to surrender. But they just outceased to exist.
When these guys got up to, and I don't remember which one of those villages it was. It was during Market Garden. I don't know if he got into Arnhem or if it was in one of the other smaller villages. But the German artillery fire was so heavy, Dad and another guy crawled in some candy ovens. There was a candy factory there.
Mm-hmm.
And they crawled in.
I remember him saying that.
Dude,
they got in there.
For protection.
Yeah.
Safe. Yeah. It was the safest place they could.
Yeah, because they were just getting, I mean, it was just, mm-hmm. There was nowhere to go. And they were in this candy factory with these great big ovens. And they crawled inside these ovens. Until the shelling ceased or slowed down.
Did your father, yours, or anyone's, did they have any opinion of the Germans and how well they were trained or not well trained or how they fought or did they just not even?
My dad had a great deal of respect for the Germans, mm-hmm. the German soldiers, and he always made the comment that they were just like us,
yeah.
and clean people, and mm-hmm. he had very little use for the French.
Hmm.
He didn't like the French, and the Arabs were worse.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want anything to do with them. And, but he didn't. He liked the English and the Australians,
mm-hmm.
pretty much all of them. But he said he just thought the French were lazy,
mm-hmm.
and
okay.
that was
my dad
all his life.
Here they ran into the German 5th Parachute Division twice, and he said they were ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a high opinion of the German combat soldier. Now, later in the war, like during the Battle of the Bulge in January of 45, they started running into, as the tide turned, when they got relieved at Bastogne, which Buford's dad,
they were at Mache, they were with the 82nd instead of the 101st, but they were cut off just like they were.
Mm-hmm.
As the tide turned there, you know, I have a belt. That my dad took off of a German soldier.
Oh, okay.
He was about 16 years old.
Yeah, because by that time they were putting the older men and the younger boys.
Look how small it is.
Yeah.
You know, he reached down and just pulled it off. And mm-hmm. he said he rolled over and he was about 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. Did he bring other souvenirs?
Yeah,
I've got some. He's got, he had some money and he took it. I asked him where he got it and he said, I took it out of a dead German's pack. And I said, didn't that bother you? And he said, no. He said, we'd just come through Liège, Belgium, and they'd line 11 GIs up on the altar and executed them. And he said, I wasn't in a very good mood about German soldiers right then. And he said, that money was sticking out as I run down the road and I just grabbed a handful of it. But
mm-hmm.
he said the guy had been cut in two with a machine gun. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was, you know, like in the Battle of the Bulge where they massacred a lot of the Americans at Malmedy, it was, there was not a lot of quarter given on either side there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is a, and I have the gun actually also, but this is a holster from a, and his name is inside it. It's Oberst-Lieutenant Dr. Henne. It was a German doctor.
Mm.
And they had overrun a field hospital,
mm-hmm.
and they just disarmed them and left them.
Mm-hmm.
That is from an SS officer, and I have the gun also. I have a hat band in here somewhere off of an SS officer's hat. Mm-hmm. Obviously, none of them were living there. They wouldn't have given them up.
Right. Well, they were particularly hated, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And those are the...
That's, you know, two of his Purple Hearts. I have a newspaper article. I couldn't find it to come. That my grandma had given us, where it shows a newspaper article, my dad being awarded the Distinguished Service Cross.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have it.
Hmm.
And I don't
get a hold of Jerry Moran's office.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to follow up on that, because there's a newspaper article.
Right.
His Bronze Star, and it's kind of a funny story. I'll read just a citation right quick, but he kind of grumped about part of this. Corporal Lewis Eugene Hilker Jr., and it has his serial number, parachute infantry, while serving with the Army of the United States, distinguished himself by heroic achievement in action. On 7 June 1944, in the vicinity of Carentan, France, he voluntarily accompanied a small group across open terrain covered by enemy fire in an attempt to prevent an enemy force of unknown size from reaching concealed positions in a wooded area, from where they would direct harassing fire on the regiment defending the all-important locks near the town. Armed only with a machine gun and carrying very little ammunition, Corporal Hilker took up a position 900 yards in front of his lines and held off the enemy until his ammunition was expended. He then withdrew with the group, drawing enemy fire after him so that the other members of the group of the regiment, of the regiment occupying defensive positions could open fire on the enemy. The outstanding courage, aggressiveness, and devotion of duty of Corporal Hilker contributed greatly to effecting the surrender of a large enemy force with a minimum of ammunition and loss of lives. His actions are in accordance with the highest standards of the military service. He entered military service from Kansas.
And what did he grump about?
That the lieutenant got a silver star and he and another guy got the bronze star, and they said the only damn difference was he was a lieutenant and we were just enlisted guys.
Well, didn't Don get a silver star?
Not that we know of. Dad's records were burned in a warehouse fire in 1957 in St. Louis.
Yes.
So Catherine always wanted his Purple Heart. So before he passed away, John got a hold of Senator Moran's office. And through other sources, they got his European Theater of Operations Medal, his Rifleman's Badge, and his Bronze Star.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not being militarily inclined, I wasn't smart enough to know. And so, after Cynthia married Kevin, who's active military today, John showed it to him. And Kevin says, oh, he won it 3 times.
Yeah.
Oh.
And
did he have oak leaves?
Had 2 stars up here on the banner. He said, well, that's 1, that's 2, and that's 3. He said, but we have no citations.
See,
we don't have any of the records.
See, and we're the same thing.
For.
On my dad's discharge papers, it says bronze stars, 2 oak leaf clusters.
Yeah.
That's
more.
Two more. But
so when did they get the medals? While they were over there, when they got home, or?
Depends. Part of them they got while they were over there. Dad said when Dad nearly severed his arm, that tank shell, and he was just lucky to be alive. He was lost, wandering around the next day when the sun came up, and an Army field hospital unit was moving up.
Oh.
And this Dad said he was just lucky, but there was a doctor riding in the Jeep, and he saw him wandering around out there, and he told his driver, he said, go out there, there's something wrong with that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they come driving out there, had lost a lot of blood, but they were going to take his arm off below the elbow, so that's the reason he didn't go back into any more.
And then they treated him there, and then did they take him then back to another?
Well, they just went with the field hospital unit, and when they set up, and then, you know, they got the bleeding stopped, dressed it and stuff, and Dad said one of the surgeons come by and asked him how he was doing, and his tendons were sticking out of the bandage, you know, about 1.5 inches.
Doing great.
And he said, well, I'm doing all right. those are kind of bothering me. He said the old surgeon just pulled a pair of scissors out of his pocket and just cut them off.
Really?
Because there's no feeling in your tendons. Well, they were going to cut his arm off below the elbow, so it didn't matter. Well, then there was a young captain assigned to this unit who was fresh over from the States and out of medical school. And so Dad had to sign a release to let him try to save his arm, mm-hmm. the experiment, basically. But if it didn't work, he would lose his elbow. That was the game. He had to give up his elbow. Well, so they saved it, but he spent months with his hand like this because they had to stretch those damn tendons back out that got cut off, see?
I forgot.
And he never had any, the only feeling he had in his hand was just skin deep.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't, and they put aluminum foil in there and tried to get those nerves to grow down. That was part of the experiments, but it never did.
Mm-hmm. And he had, I remember him telling me, you know, when he shook hands, he said he just never had the grip. Never had the grip I used to
yeah.
have.
Mm-hmm. And when yeah. we would pick up 100-pound sacks of cake, you know, he could pick them up with his left hand all day long, but he
yeah.
got two sacks and his right hand was done. And mm-hmm. just, but he, it's like you say about, you know, his wound went clear across,
mm-hmm.
almost clear to his elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And he had one of the pieces of shrapnel that was still in his arm.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the size of a quarter and about half inch thick, and it's got the threads on it. It was part of the
yeah.
shell case, you mm-hmm. know, the warhead.
Mm-hmm.
He just darn lucky to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
See, and he got blew out of a foxhole in the bulge.
Mm-hmm.
Part of his medical record when they got him at Wichita, he was having neck problems, and they did stuff for him through the VA and stuff. But his doctor at Wichita told him one time, he said, "Yeah, that's quite a medical record. Shell shock somewhere in Belgium." Yeah. And he got blew out of a foxhole, and as long as he was in the foxhole, he was fine. As soon as they put him up top, he didn't know who he was or where he was or anything
mm-hmm.
else.
Mm-hmm.
So they took him to the aid station, and they kept him a couple of days, kind of like your dad's.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got to where he was functioning all right, so they sent him back up, but he didn't tell him. He had a paper he had to carry in his pocket, because he couldn't, they told him every steel pot on his head would make his, give him a headache after a little bit because of the trouble with his neck. And so he had a paper in his pocket. If any officer chewed him out for not having his steel pot on, he just wore the liner
mm-hmm.
and he carried the pot. And then when they come under fire, he'd put the pot on.
Okay.
And but he had this letter from this doctor saying he could do that.
Mm-hmm. When he came home from the war, do you ever remember your mother saying that he talked about the war to her?
My four older siblings said they don't know hardly any of the
okay.
the war stories because he wouldn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing Mom told us, or Catherine told us, and she remembers, is Dad hadn't been back too long, and Mom and Dad had some friends over and they were playing cards, and Donnie found some caps and crawled in behind the van and hit one of those caps with a hammer and said Dad was just flat on the floor
mm-hmm.
and just embarrassed himself to death because yeah. he just reacted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a rifle shot. And we watched a deal on TV. I think that's part of the reason John and I heard many more stories than the mm-hmm. others, because you had GI combat and stuff
yeah.
on TV, and we loved to watch that, and he would watch
some. And I would just badger my
yeah,
dad.
Yeah.
I mean, I just badger him until.
Do you think that he talked to your mother about it at all? Did she?
Yeah, and she worked in an aircraft factory in Wichita. They were living in Wichita then, and she told me she would give me enough information where I could pester him and get him
mm-hmm.
to say some things. I would ask him when I was a little kid, "Did you kill any Germans?"
Yeah.
You know, he would never.
Right.
You know, he would never say. He told me a story about when they were in Operation Market Garden, and I don't remember which village it was, if it was Zeckel or Nijmegen or whatever. He was going forward. He was a forward observer for a mortar platoon, and those guys generally didn't survive long.
Mm-hmm.
But supposedly this was a secure village, secure town, and he said he walked around the corner. He said, "I was just walking down the sidewalk." I went around the corner, and he said, "Next block down, there's two German staff officers standing out there smoking cigarettes." And I just asked him, "Did you kill them?"
Mm-hmm.
He says, hell no. I went right back around that corner running as fast as I could. And I said, I didn't understand that. I said, why did you do that? And he said, if they were confident enough to stand out on the sidewalk smoking cigarettes, two officers, there was Germans everywhere.
Yeah, there was way too many.
And he said, it was, you know, and I said, but you could have killed two officers. And he said, I was better served getting back and telling them this is not secure by any stretch. And he said that was the right thing to do. Was to go tell them, no, this is not secure. It's not even close.
Yeah. And the men that said that you visited with, did you ever get the feeling that they had talked a lot about their experiences, hadn't, or?
I don't think so. Most of them were pretty quiet. They didn't talk much.
Okay.
Remember Bryce Ramsey talking about, he was with the 14th Air Force over in South Georgia.
Over the hump.
And they were doing bomb runs on some of those Japanese installations along the China coast and then some of the island deals further out. I remember him talking about this one island. They'd go in there and they'd blow up these buildings and the Japanese would build them back and they'd come back and blow them up. And then one time says we came over there and our bombardier miscalculated and he dropped the bombs in a palm grove over next to him. And he says all heck blew up over there.
Yeah.
He says the Japanese had all their supplies and ammunition over there in the palm trees and they built his building back because they knew that
you get them
and think they got them. So, and I don't know what Bryce was, whether he was a radio man or
and Bryce was a Bryce Ramsey?
Yeah.
He was a belly gunner on a B-17.
Was that? That's right.
And then later, he flew as a loadmaster when they were flying supplies into Burma.
Oh, yeah.
Over the Himalayas.
So now I
remember Bill Bailey talking about those. He was making that run over the hump.
My dad ran into Jack Davidson.
Okay, that's a question I was going to ask you. Did they run into other people from Cimarron or even Kansas?
I'm trying to think. No, it was Russ Monocle. Let's see. Russ Monocle ran into Jack Davidson in Honolulu. I'm trying to think who my dad ran into in London.
Did they talk about the friendships that they made? Did they keep up with anyone?
My dad went to reunions, and there would be where the stories,
yeah.
Like when you asked Sid, did they talk here in town? Not so much, but my brother went to a couple of reunions with my dad, and you get the booze flowing, and those guys would get to talking. One of the guys, he just recently passed away, came up and put his arm around my older brother, and he had this big old bent over nose, and he was telling my brother, "Didn't you see this nose like this?" And of course, Dave said, "Yeah," and he says, "That son of a bitch right there, give it to me." It was my dad. They'd gotten a fight over in London because they were chomping at the bit. You know, they trained and trained and trained and trained. You know, and then they'd get off. The paratroopers got off every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
They would get a pass every weekend as part of being a paratrooper.
The little extra special.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. He's talking about his dad and gets to go back to England after they were relieved. And when my dad and them went, see, they assigned the 84th Infantry to the 82nd Airborne, and they took over Marche, France, just like the 101st took over Bastogne.
Mm-hmm.
And they were cut off and overrun and everything. And Dad always said, yeah, he said, I jumped the same frickin' 3 feet from the tailgate of a truck to the ground the 82nd did. And when they finally got to us and relieved us, the 82nd went to England and we went to Holland. And but he always talked about, you know, they got to R&R in Holland. I think it's a great, you know, I must have been there for weeks.
Yeah.
I get his combat narrative. They were there 7 days.
Yeah.
7 days they went right back into the front line. And
yep.
And the 84th Infantry Division in World War II didn't land until, what was it, September that they landed in France? I think November. 1 through 4 November 44 landed over Omaha Beach, and war ended in 45, and the 84th Infantry Division suffered 69.7% casualties in that less than a year's time.
You just wonder why, how they went on.
They just got chewed up after they got
the trucks that he's talking about when they left Paris. My dad went.
You're talking about the liberation of Paris.
No, this is when they were going towards when the Battle of the Bulge was happening.
It broke out. They were trying to stop.
My dad was in. He was on leave in Paris, and he'd been to a USO show the night before, and he went back to the USO building, headquarters, dance hall, whatever it was, and the next day, and a gal said, "What are you doing here, Hilker?" "Well, I came to get what for whatever reason he was there." And he said, "Well, the 101st left last night." Well, that was news to him. He'd been out on the town, and so he finds out at the USO, they say where you're. So he goes, and he was on one of the last few trucks. And of course, when he's telling me his story, I was on the last truck out of Paris. Well, whether it was or wasn't, I don't know. But you know, just like Buford's dad, he jumped 3 feet, you know, in Bastogne. And you know, there's all these guys streaming out of there, and these guys are going in.
Yeah.
And that was their casualty rate was from when they shipped out of the United States and when they came back. The 501 that my dad was in, their casualty rate was 150%.
Now, did they know that, or you know that because you?
We know that now, but it's like my dad said. He said you didn't make friends with the new guys because they were always the first ones that got killed.
Mm-hmm. You know, they knew it was they had heavy losses.
Dad told me one time, and my son-in-law, after he got back from Iraq, I never said anything to him, but he told me exactly the same thing. I was surprised, but he said my dad said, the first thing you had to come to grips with, it was either your time or it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you had to come to grips with that, then you could function. Mm-hmm. He said, might be God and country that got you over here, but he says, cornered cat that got you out.
Yeah.
He said, you were just like a cornered animal
mm-hmm.
when you got in the scrapes. And my son-in-law told me, he said, you know, that's the first thing you had to come to grips with in Iraq mm-hmm. was that, if it's your time, it don't make a damn how good or how bad a soldier you are.
Mm-hmm.
If it's your time, you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to accept that.
Did either of your fathers or anyone that you visited with, did they say anything about their religious faith? Did it help them? Did they pray? You know.
My dad had, and this is interesting, I just recently got in contact with a young man in Holland who's taking care of graves around Arnhem, and we've been exchanging information. And he put me in contact with a guy that served with my dad. And this guy that served with my dad is really savvy on the computer, and it's been really fascinating. But the way this happened is he's taking care of a guy's name, Francis Fernand,
mm-hmm.
who was killed right behind my dad. I remember the story of Francis being killed. And they called him the priest, Monsignor. He was such a devout Catholic
mm-hmm.
that they were walking amongst all the flooded ground. They were trying to flood out all these paratroopers, and they would walk right down next to the water along these dikes so your head wouldn't be up above the dike, and a mortar round from the Germans came in and landed virtually right next to Francis and killed him. Well, the ground was soft and it impacted fairly deep. That didn't hurt my dad, and they were just one in front of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm scrolling through this website, I'm scrolling down, and here comes handwriting up as I scroll, and it's my dad's. He had written Francis's mother in 1946, and they had posted that letter. It's on Fallen Heroes, and they posted that letter of my dad's to her, and I mean the hair stood up on him. My dad's been gone 10 or 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize, I mean, dear Mrs. Fernand, I recognize the handwriting. And then as I read the letter, she was wanting information about how her son was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly graphic about what had happened. And then the kid that's taking care of Francis's grave over there was wanting to know if I knew anything. Well, my dad was pretty good friend. And that's one of the stories that I remember as far as being pretty graphic
mm-hmm.
about what happened, because Francis was... He was kind of like the de facto priest of their little unit, even though they didn't have one. They kind of looked at him as one.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then he was killed. And he was one of the early guys. He was at Camp Tocoa with him. And
mm-hmm.
And my dad's headquarters company, Mortar Platoon, there was he and a guy named Doc Holden from Tishomingo, Oklahoma, were the only two that started from Camp Tocoa and went through all of them mm-hmm. and went home on the same boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think hard money.
Dad kind of is.
Insurance company years ago, an underwriter.
Mm. Who was, what is it?
Howard Gray okay. was his name. He was not a native of Cimarron, but he was a forward observer, went in shortly after D-Day
mm-hmm.
and went clear across Europe. And he was talking about times when they get shelled and some people get killed, and he never said, we'd always take the coats off of guys who got, if it was okay, if they were short, and, well, they're mm-hmm. cold.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, remember getting some overshoes off a fellow that, and I think he said there were six or seven of them out of that company that started out with about 215 men that got to the other clear through.
You talking about overshoes, when that truck that my dad caught went to go to Bastogne, he said, I grabbed two things for provisions. He said, and they're telling us, hurry, hurry, hurry. He said, I grabbed a pair of overshoes. And I grabbed an overcoat. So they didn't tell us where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no idea where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I just had this feeling as I'm running through there that, you know, being an old farm kid, you know,
he
grabbed
that
some overshoes and an overcoat.
Yeah. They were just the opposite. They pulled them out of the front lines on the 18th of December and then sent them, or they had, were in the front in the 18th of December, and then the 21st they pulled them out and put them, sent them to, to Marche.
Yeah.
Well, they dropped them 11 miles out and told them to take what they needed for 11 mile hike. They didn't tell them what was going on. They thought they were going back.
Yeah.
See, they'd been in the front for yep. weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, take what you need for 11 mile hike. So Dad said, everybody threw their overcoats and their overshoes back in the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought they were walking back. It was dark. They didn't have any idea. He said, then we knew we were in deep shit when 5 miles down the road, they issued us all two bandoliers of ammo. He said, you ain't going back with two bandoliers
yeah.
of ammo. And so, he said, 6 hours later, their division had two Jeeps left.
Yeah.
And they told him when they got up there that this German spearhead offensive was coming through here. They probably told the 101st the same thing.
Yeah.
And they said, we want you to blunt it, and we don't expect to see any of you.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It was just that blunt.
So what was their attitude, opinion about being poorly equipped or not having equipment or not getting the right information? I mean, someone should have told them to take their
own. They had a job to do.
Okay. All right.
And they were, for the every hour they bought here, saved thousands of lives back there.
See, and
that's the way they looked at it.
His dad had been out of combat only just a little bit.
Right.
My dad had come out of Market Garden where they'd been in combat about 72 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were just getting refitted, new guys sent. They had been, they came out of there about October 1st. So they'd had about November 1st, December 1st. They had about two and a half months to get re-equipped, refitted, because they'd lost over half of their men and equipment. So a little different with what his dad experienced and my dad, except these guys were, you know,
yeah,
my dad's
guys went in on D-Day, and Dad didn't
early
really
November
tell November
before
so.
They ever got back to Paris where they were
yeah.
getting refitted.
Yeah, they pulled out of combat about
they were
October
in there
1st.
For 72 days while Market Garden started on September 17th and ended about a week later.
Yeah,
yeah. So
I mean, as far as,
yeah, as far as that operation
that,
being over.
That part of the operation, yeah. And then they found out they couldn't get that last bridge, and then they of course they had to hold all the territory.
Yeah, then it was a fighting retreat. And
did they ever say anything about, was it difficult for them to follow orders or anything like that?
I don't think that.
A lot of the men said, no, we were used to it at home. I mean, we were told what to do at home, and when we went into the Army, we just...
Dad made the one comment he made about that. Of course, he was a radio man, and in a platoon structure, radio... your scouts or whatever you want to call them are up front, and then your platoon lieutenant and the radio man, and then the squads move up behind that, the four squads. And he said that, I asked him one time, You're right out there in front. Somebody, and he said, oh, he said, it's better than being in back of the squads because the Germans, if you could get three soldiers with an 88, it was worth the round. So if there was less than three, they normally wouldn't shoot an artillery round at you. They'd just wait on you with rifles. So he said artillery fire about always come in behind them. But he said that the way the Army taught the officers was, you know, the radio men, the lieutenants here, and then if you encounter the enemy, then the lieutenant and the radio men are supposed to move back behind the squads, and then the squads, and direct the squads. And Dad said, nobody goes back.